That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
You want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
For 15 years, I've been trying to teach you how to write a lead. Do I have to do everything myself? Get the story? Write the story?
Listen, saphead, I could blow a better story out of my nose than you can write.
It's the Week in Review on KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scheer. Joni Balter is here. She is news analyst for this humble radio station, also host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel.
Good morning to you, Steve.
Eli J. Sanders is here, associate editor at The Stranger.
Nice to be here.
And John Talton is here, economics columnist for the Seattle Times, novelist, rogue columnist, many different hats.
Any outfit that has Humphrey Bogart from Deadline USA, I want to be a part of.
Yeah, that should be the quiz, if you can name all the movies and all the journalists. We have so many we have yet to explore or exploit in that little segment. That was a great movie. It's good to see you.
Thank you.
In this capacity, because John Talton also comes to see us on the record, and we make him analyze macroeconomic trends in 3 minutes or less. I thought we could talk about some things you were writing about, and also this census data that Gene Balk at the Seattle Times put on the front page of the paper yesterday. Seattle is the fastest growing major city in the United States. He was deeming that in terms of population, and that got us thinking about growth and what you've been writing about in terms of what's happening in the city. But how'd that make you feel? Coming from Phoenix, John, how'd that make you feel?
Well, from Phoenix, my reaction is, you call this growth? You mean it's not 100,000 people a year? Population growth is a very rough metric for civic health and economic health, because what you want to be doing is growing PhDs, and you want to be growing the talent that you're attracting. You want to be growing venture capital. You want to be growing elements of civic health by taking care of the least and the last. But it is a good sign, because it's a moderate increase. It not only shows the health of this economy, but it shows the back to the city movement, where young talent, empty nest baby boomers, a whole bunch of people want to be in high quality cities. But also remember that population growth brings costs, and so it's not an unalloyed good.
Yeah. I was thinking I'd ask you guys also as well. So where you live and where you work on Capitol Hill, mm-hmm. Eli J. Sanders. Mm-hmm.
Or at Eli J. Sanders.
At, yeah, yeah.
That's also where I live and where I work. On Twitter.
In the Twitter sphere. Yeah. How does that feel, growth?
Yeah. You can feel it. I mean, we have really noticed it at The Stranger and on Capitol Hill. And, you know, I live on Capitol Hill also, so you experience it every day. There's a very clear sense that just the crowds of people who wash through the Pike Pine corridor on Saturday night, Friday night, are actually different in makeup than they used to be. That the people who used to be in those crowds and could live on Capitol Hill, a lot of them can't afford to live there anymore and are moving out of the Capitol Hill area, and a new crowd is coming in. And it's not quite clear what that crowd is exactly, but it has more money than the old crowd, because rents are higher and you have to have more money to live on the Hill. We feel the population explosion or surge in that way, that there's a particular quality to the people that are moving to Seattle right now, and that is that they have money and employment that can allow them to live in a city that is not only growing in population, but is growing in the cost of living.
Well, there was kind of a mixture in terms of response to this story. A little bit of wincing and a little bit of pride kind of mixed together, if you think about it. So you wince in that way that in many other boom and bust cycles, we used to have the group called Lesser Seattle, you know, during one of the tech boom, where Emmett Watson from the Seattle Times long ago would write about, you know, how do we stop this? So he had some unpleasant phrases like KBO, keep the B-word people out. But also, it is what's going on. The folks who are coming here, they're readers, they're highly educated. They're, as we know, they're connected sometimes to startups, because some of what is going on with the growth, and it's been pointed out by you, John Talton, and many others. It's Amazon. Amazon is driving a lot of this in some ways. And I have my daughter here visiting from California, so she knows a little bit about what growth looks like, but she hadn't seen Seattle lately. And as you go to different neighborhoods and you just see, you know, the big, huge, sometimes bulky apartment buildings going up, you can see it. You could, like, just like Eli said, you can see it, you can feel it. The place is growing. Now, we are boom and bust, but at this moment, can't see bust on the horizon.
And the waves of growth, just to illustrate it on Capitol Hill, you know, there was a time when it was an auto row, and you have all those buildings that used to be auto dealers, auto display shops. Then they became, the facades of them started to house coffee shops, small independent businesses. And now the most common thing on Capitol Hill is for a developer to buy one of those big blocks and tear out the insides, the guts of an old auto dealer building that was housing a coffee shop, take Bauhaus, for example. Tear that out, keep the facade, build a 6 or 8 story apartment or condo building in it, and jack up the prices on the condos and or apartments and sell it to the Amazon workers and other people who are moving in.
You know, I moved to Belltown and moved into this condo, say, 6 years ago, I had a view straight east up Capitol Hill. I could see the I-5 bridge. And then maybe 3 years ago, there were 6 cranes on the skyline. My view has completely changed. Now, that's the price of having a vibrant city. I'm not saying, where's my view? You know, we used to take the ferry over to Shelbyville. But it is a remarkable change. And yes, it's heavily driven by Amazon. That's not the only thing. But from my little
Gates,
view,
too.
It's huge. Gates, Starbucks continues to do very well. Like it or not, you have a port. But the other thing about these big players is that they create a universe of vendors, other companies working with them, and they spin off talent who say, I'm sick of working at Amazon. I'm going to go do my own startup. And so it's just the gift that keeps on giving. We should never take it for granted, because in 2008, we were staring at the abyss. But it's a remarkable comeback.
So when you mentioned auto dealers, I was thinking of South Lake Union and going back to the 2 votes on the commons. Because if you remember, one of the arguments, or many of the arguments, were let's keep what's there. You know, it's old-fashioned, it's funky, it's old Seattle. There was Mike, is this the right name? Mike Foley's auto dealer, if that's the right name.
Well, it was Mike Foley. I think he had, the company was.
Right. So let's keep these low-slung, you know, kind of funky buildings. But that is so not what happened. And so what you have is you have all the up development without the park. So just
we
something that we consider.
We stuck it to the man, as Ron Judd said.
So there's two things on that. And one is that you, how has that affected your media institutions? So you know, when you were talking about The Stranger and us on Capitol Hill, how do you think this growth is either shaping your news coverage or shaping your business plan?
Well, no one consults me on the business plan very wisely, so there's
very that. Wisely they don't consult
very you. Wisely they don't consult me, but
sentence structure,
sorry. They also don't consult me on grammar,
sentence structure. Okay, good.
It's shaping our coverage, I think, in the sense that there's just so much more to cover. It feels like there's so much going on in the city right now. And I think that's partly connected to the population influx and the need to deal with that. And so, you know, it's an embarrassment of riches in a way in terms of coverage. There's just so much to write about right now.
So as a Times alum and a Times, Seattle Times worker, I mean, there was a time when there was a thought that the Times was in trouble and that the city couldn't hold 2 newspapers to in the same town, that sort of thing, 2 well, daily papers. So does the growth
it should translate well? I mean, there was a time, and folks sort of accepted, that you couldn't have 2 major daily newspapers that were delivered, because the PI is still effectively online, but, you know, much slimmer version of itself.
And so slimmer is a nice way to put it.
So the notion is that this population should be able to support 1 major daily. not certain how well or not well that is going. But, you know, for some other work I do for Bloomberg View, I have the impression that they're so interested in the city that is booming in a business sense. There's so much business stuff going on here that there's this new interest in, you know, what's going on in Washington, whereas if a couple of years ago, I don't think they would have been as interested.
We're doing okay within the context of the broken business model in the newspaper industry, in that it used to be retail and classified ads drove the show, and nobody's really found a way to quite fix that. We're blessed with a literate city. Now, having said that, it is a calamity that the PI in print went away. I was in Denver for the Rocky Mountain News Denver Post fight, and the city was made richer for it. I cried the day the last edition of the PI came out. But better them than us.
There's one other thing about this, though, and you wrote this in a post, What's Driving Seattle's Growth. You said, pivoting off of Gene Balk's story in the Times yesterday, Americans are poorer since the Great Recession. Jobs are more scarce. The old mobility hasn't returned. So we are, and we're going to touch on this more in the extra on the record, but we are physically in a bubble. And so the fact that this growth is happening and we see the growth in cranes, the people left out may also be moving out.
Sure. I mean, there will be people priced out of this city. This has happened in the Bay Area. This has happened in Boston. You're having these metro areas pulling apart. And, you know, a place like Dayton, Ohio, really nice city. There just aren't the good jobs there anymore because those kind of industries have been destroyed by our wonderful financial services sector and other factors. So we're almost the city-state that the state legislature fears. What they don't quite get is that we're the city-state that generates the income that the rest of them mooch off of.
I would like to hear the Times say that more often, actually.
Mooch off of?
Well,
no, read John's column.
I do read John's column, but I would like to hear that on the editorial page more. We talk about this frequently, that some of the arguments that are made in Olympia and that we also hear on the Times editorial page don't take into account the overwhelming contribution that Seattle makes to the state's finances.
Well, I think there's no better example of how the legislature treats Seattle than in the area of transportation. This business about transit, which I will maybe talk about more in detail. In a moment or two, you never know. But this area is very important. The legislature could not get its act together, had sort of no interest. And it's a big deal. If you buy the fact, and a lot of people do, that Seattle's the economic engine, you certainly want to help said economic engine have people moving in and out without sitting on freeways all day.
And I would just say, back to the growth question, I don't think it's any coincidence that in the fastest growing city in America, where that growth is big city in America, where that growth is fueled a lot by the new economy, internet economy, that you also are seeing the first real $15 an hour now movement. Because
you don't think it's a coincidence.
I don't think it's a coincidence because, as John was saying, when cities grow in this way, people on the lower end of the economic ladder start to get priced out of the city, but you need them to make the city run, and they want to be able to stay in the city. And Seattle's sense of itself wants a mix of classes in the city, and so we end up supporting $15.
See, I was thinking in terms of the coverage, the people that read The Stranger, the demographic The Stranger shoots for in general. Mm-hmm. We're not Portland. Right. And we're not that level of economic health in Portland, that strata, I should say, is and can support The Stranger. I know I'm making many stereotypes, but this is a stereotype day today in the show. you want to be, you don't want those people to be like police officers or firemen in this town who have to live in far out and come into the city and enjoy the perks The Stranger writes about and then
this
have
is,
to leave
this is
again.
The Aspenization or something,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's exactly. Got to be a concern, right?
Well, yes.
Yeah. Fair enough. That was a long speech, and you can say yes, of course.
I agree with it.
That's the beauty of being the host. All right, we're going to take a break, and we will come back. This is the Week in Review from KUOW Seattle. By the way, Bernard.
Yes, sir.
Darn nice sweater.
Thank you.
I did not know it was snowing outside, but a very nice sweater.
I'm glad you like it, Steve. That means a lot to me.
Bernard looks like he's getting ready for gonna get a warm glass of punch and sit down by the fire.
Yeah, I'm waiting for that glass of punch, by the way. So during this break, maybe you can go hook
me up. I'll go get it.
Thanks, man. Thanks for the punch, Steve.
You're welcome, Bernard. I had to go pretty far. I had to go all the way to the North Pole. I had to go all the way to Christmas. Thank you.
The grog shop down on the Ave.
I'm sure there is a grog shop. John Talton is here. He writes about economics and macro and micro business aspects of the world for the Seattle Times at his own column, his own blog, theroguecolumnist.com. He's also the author of a number of excellent mysteries about Phoenix and about the Midwest too, Cincinnati.
And Seattle.
Oh, and Seattle, that's right. Deadline Man.
Deadline Man.
That's right. You're spread across the whole country. Eli J. Sanders is here. He writes for The Stranger and Think Pieces for The Stranger, one that he wrote almost 10 years ago. We're going to talk about a little bit. Joni Balter's here. She writes for Bloomberg View and also is the host of the Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. So since you mentioned transit before our break, I thought I could come. Let's talk about that. We have a transit proposal that is before various factions, and it calls for similar to what voters voted on in King County, a 0.1% sales tax, a $6 car tab, in order to pay for bus routes in Seattle, and a little money left over to hook up with other municipalities around the region and also institutions that they want to save their particular bus routes. So it's an a la carte plan, as we talked about. Now, Nick Licata and Shama Sawant have proposed a slightly different aspect of that. And Licata has this idea that let's basically reinstitute a head tax we had on business and also jack up the parking for commercial parking. Here, we talked to him a little earlier. Here's what he had to say about it.
What we're doing here is making sure that we have great bus service to allow their employees and perhaps themselves to get to work without being stuck in traffic jams. And that has a definite economic financial benefit to businesses.
So that was the question I asked him, and that was what he was responding to was, how are businesses who are affected by this going to respond to an employee tax?
I had a couple thoughts about this. First of all, it's interesting that the DSA, the Downtown Seattle Association, has been very active in supporting certainly not the Licata and Sawant proposal, but any other proposal to ensure that bus service continues, because what was the percentage? There's a high percentage of workers who come into the city who ride the bus. And so it is very much a downtown Seattle kind of issue. I was interested in this proposal because I've been waiting for Sawant and Licata to line up as a political group. It's not a big group. It's two. But so here it is. The head tax and the parking tax have been tried before. They were recalled for Bridging the Gap. They were in there along with some other things, the Bridging the Gap program, Greg Nichols' plan to, you know, fix roads and bridges and all this. Business hates this kind of a tax, and they will vigorously oppose this proposal. And it will, if they're not already on board, they'll get on board the other proposal that came from the mayor after he said he and Dow Constantine would get together and come up with something that would work. But the fact is that the city and the legislature, if they get in the mood kind of thing, need to deal with the transit and all the other transportation projects in the city. It's not a maybe.
Licata himself said that he voted to recall that head tax that was in place because of the recession in 2008. And they lower commercial property rates, parking rates a little bit, and now they want to raise them back up. That part I am not remembering. But is there an economic, from your perspective, is this always going to be the case where businesses are going to go, I will leave, this is too onerous? Or can you find a sweet spot where an employee tax might be acceptable?
Let me start at 30,000 feet and go down quickly.
Hold on to your parachute.
I'll hang on.
We have in this country a circa 1970 transportation system.
That's about
right. And it has no future. And it's contributing to climate change. Freeways aren't free. Roads don't pay for themselves. There's all this mythology out there. We don't count what economists call externalities. For instance, all of the huge costs of sprawl and all of the greenhouse gases that are spewed into the commons called the atmosphere. Any functioning big city that wants to continue to attract talent and have quality of life has got to have a great transit system. And that we're so stuck with buses is an atrocity. I mean, stand on
because
Third
they're stuck in traffic.
Yeah, stand on Third Avenue at rush hour and watch six of them line up. And meanwhile, Atlanta's got our subway system. I mean, it's just insane. We shoot ourselves in the foot. We reload. Now that's from 30,000 feet. So you know, we've got to preserve what we have. We've got to do more. It is a travesty that light rail construction is taking so long. That needs to be sped up. I mean, on the east side, they ought to be building their segment of light rail before the I-90 bridge so that it's functioning between downtown Bellevue and Redmond. I mean, this is just nuts. Now, things like the head tax need some real empirical study, and here's the reason. The old suburban office, quote-unquote, park is pretty much dying and dead in many places. But the east side is very uneasy about Seattle's great success since the recession. And this is not just Kemper. I mean, this is the newer developers and leaders over there who want to have an urbanized east side. They would love nothing better than to start picking off companies from Seattle. So it sounds good, and I'm not reflexively necessarily against it, but if there is no healthy metropolitan area in America that does not have a good, strong downtown, and downtown's not the enemy, and so Seattle had better be very careful to maximize its attractiveness.
So two thoughts real quickly. First of all, Kemper has become like Cher, so he's just one name.
Kemper and Freeman. And is constantly making his comeback.
So there's that.
But many comeback tours, I can't count them.
But dare I bring up Bertha and her twin, not quite twin sister, Brenda. When you talk about road building and you talk about light rail building, these two machines came from the same manufacturer, as I understand it, and the smaller one that's digging light rail is the one that's getting places, and the other one digging that roadway is the one that's sitting there going, I have a gap year coming this year.
A gap year.
This is what happens when you name it Bertha.
I'm with you on this.
I mean, into the Capitol Grill, look at the portrait of our former mayor, and you can see that she has cursed this. You know, it's like, this is what you do to me.
Back to the bus plan, the Lakota Swant plan, as I understand it, is built around the idea that the head tax and the commercial parking tax hike are less regressive than the sales tax proposal that Murray put forward. And so I think that is the benefit to their plan. Now, I agree, two people doesn't make a council majority. So there's the problem at the moment.
You know that, but from 30,000 feet again, this is the argument. This is the I guess this isn't 30,000 feet. This is what's on the ground when we talk about what makes a vibrant city, why Seattle is growing, who's coming here, and what's creating the economy, which is, you know, driving some people out and bringing other people in.
This is one of the fundamental problems with the Brookings Institution's meme that cities will drive things forward in an era of gridlock. The Washington state tax system is so broken. It is so out of sync with what's necessary for a populous, highly urbanized state in the 21st century. And yet, with this control of exurban and rural legislators and this anti-Seattle feeling, Seattle is stymied at every step in getting
the appropriate revenue from the appropriate sources.
I am so thrilled to have someone else on the show saying this, because we've joked for a long time at how much of a broken record I end up sounding like. So I thank you, John, for joining
us. Good to hear you were joking. But I have a thought about this, and that is, you know, some of what goes on is, yeah, we thank you, Seattle, for being the economic engine, but we're just a tad jealous. And that does seep in a little bit to Bellevue, I believe, because one of the arguments about, and I am switching gears here for a second.
You can do that.
I can do that. One of the arguments about $15 minimum wage, and I heard Rodney Tom say this at a City Club event, was watch and see. We're going to get your businesses. You're either going to get our businesses in Bellevue, or you're going to adopt a higher minimum wage so you don't lose all the workers.
We're going to take your McDonald's workers, Seattle.
Speaking of minimum wage, how's the deal looking today? I mean, there was some flurry of concern about whether it was going to unravel.
Well, I was watching, frankly, the Stranger's tweets yesterday, and you would have thought for, I don't know, for several hours that the whole darn thing was coming undone. It reminds me of this giant Jenga where you pull the one piece of wood out and the whole darn thing goes down and then you lost the game and it's awful. But it seemed like what happened was this memo came out of the city council. It was long. It was a chart, which is how we explain the minimum wage around here. It's the only, you know, the best way to explain it. And it seems like, you know, all the permutations that they were considering, including the training wage, which is the one that pulled the wood piece out, that all of that was just being discussed, but it started to look like a business plan to change it dramatically. Then came a letter from the other side, eight folks, who said, this thing is really fragile, do not change it, or we'll ask you for our more worker-oriented parts of this. And I looked down at the signers, and I was one of them was Nick Hanauer, who I happened to interview this week in advance of a civic cocktail. And when I interviewed him, the whole thing was together, and he was praising the heck out of the mayor and talking about how this really, you know, you cannot move a piece because if you do, the whole thing will fall apart. And I've heard several city council members say, yes, we're going to look at it, we're going to consider everything in the memo, but the idea of big change to it, it will cause the problem. It will cause the problem. We will not have a deal. This was, you can't change it too much here.
And that was the Stranger's Anna Menard, who was tweeting from the hearing yesterday and who was raising this concern, is it falling apart? Because the rattling of swords from the outside was so strong, and because the Labor Council took a vote opposing an element of the mayor's plan that's been very contentious, and that's the training wage.
Right.
And it would take us probably 10 minutes to unpack what is so controversial at this moment about it, but people have different feelings about what it is in the plan and what it should be. But it seems to me now that the more that you have an equal amount of saber rattling from all sides against elements of this plan, the more you drive the eight members of the council who already support it together. Because Joni's right, Jenga game is a metaphor for this thing. House of Cards, people talk about it as a sweater. Also that if you pull one thread, the whole thing unravels. The mayor's plan is very delicate, and if the council members who support it now can say, look, I'm sorry, we can't start giving in to these outside demands because the whole thing will fall apart, then their support for it is that much firmer.
By the way, who plays Kevin Spacey in House of Cards?
That's a very good question.
Not Ed Murray?
No. Well, Burgess is the closest to the hairstyle. And maybe to the political strategy. I don't know.
Here's the thing. If ever there was a city that was rich enough and liberal enough to make this as a moral statement, it's Seattle, and it's Seattle in an upswing. Give it a shot. There is not an economic argument that says it's going to work. There's not one that says it's not. We don't know. There's so many problems behind the hollowing out of the middle class, the fact that you used to go into McDonald's, it was all high school kids, and then they would move on to other jobs. And now you go in and it's middle-aged people behind the counter. It is the killing of unions. It is anti-worker laws. It is bad trade policies. And look, I spent 25 years writing columns in favor of quote-unquote free trade, but we've made a bunch of bad trade deals. It is tax policy. It is this whole dog's breakfast of things that has put average Americans at a disadvantage. The minimum wage is a proxy for this. It's not going to fix it all.
I was going to say, so Michael Reich, who's done some of the research on this at Berkeley with two other researchers, what's fascinating to me about this, and he's often cited, I've talked to him at length, what's interesting is the research only goes to this very interesting number of $13.64. So the research has not gone to 15. So I agree with John because we're experimenting. We don't know. There's no research here. But Seattle on an upswing, okay, try it. Plus, it takes a long time to get there anyway. So, this is probably the place to test it. But I would say how we implement it, we want to get it right so that everyone else doesn't go, gosh, that was a disaster.
Dave Freiboth, who's the King County Labor Council leader, was talking to the folks over at Publicola, Josh Feit and Erica C. Barnett, and they've been tracking this too. And he was quoted as saying what rankled him so much about the training wage idea. What a training wage represents is a sub-minimum wage. Labor is adamantly opposed to loosely defined training wage proposals. So, I mean, people are laying out their red lines.
It kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, at the very beginning of this, everyone said, well, if we don't like what you do, we'll hit you with an initiative. So there were going to be initiatives on both sides. Now what you have is people saying, can you consider this on both sides. It's almost like they're trying to hold the whole thing together. If you ask for this, I'm going to ask for something that's pro-worker or pro-business.
With the threat of initiative still hanging out there.
You said eight council members, just real quick before the break. There, I've heard some people say that if and when this comes to a vote, it might be 9-0, even though Shama Sawant does have this other proposal and is pushing from one side. It might be 9-0. What have you heard?
Well, I hear the same. It's not really informed speculation, but speculation. I mean, you're welcome. No one knows what Sawant is going to do, but she has said the mayor's deal is imperfect, but if it was just to be voted on its own right now, I might be able to get behind it. She said things like that. So that's her way of saying, if you start to take this apart, I'm definitely not going to be on board. But if you keep it pretty much as is, then maybe I'll push for putting the 15 now initiative away and give you 9-0.
All right, we'll take a break. That was Eli Sanders. John Talton is here. Joni Balter. This is the Week in Review from KUOW. A little bit on the new SPD chief, what's happening with the VA debacle, and McLemore's faux pas. Luke Burbank will join us. That's ahead. John Talton is economics columnist for the Seattle Times. He blogs at roguecolumnist.com, and he comes on the record to talk about what's happening in the world of economics. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. Joni Balter is news analyst for KUOW, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. We have a new police chief designate, and Ross Reynolds asked incoming Seattle Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole whether she should be able to hire her top command staff from inside or outside the department. And what do you hear in this response?
I want to respect and honor those people that have made a commitment to the Seattle PD over their careers. And if there are good people internally who share the right values and are committed to working hard, then we should reward them and consider them as contenders going forward. But I also think that at this time, it's important to consider objective outside perspectives as well.
Change coming?
Change coming. We are hearing such a tussle over this. You know, this goes back to a 1978 law that no one seems to know why it came in, but it came in at the same time as Fitzsimons was in there. But we don't seem to know why. But it does put us at odds with other cities. And clearly, this new chief person, designee, is saying, I want the wide option of doing all of this. And the city council had set the table for that before. And
By changing the law, the rule that said internal hires,
that internal, external, whatever you need to be successful. And they did that specifically to attract more candidates. Now, we don't know if Kathleen O'Toole said, oh, my gosh, I'm not coming there. unless you change that rule. But her, that quote sounded like it was important enough to her.
Yes, and you can see how it would be important given the way that the department has functioned over the last few months to clear the decks on the upper command staff of the SPD and bring in your own people. So I hope Kathleen O'Toole will take advantage of the opportunity that the city council has given her and bring in as many new people as possible. She seems like a very, very exciting and hopeful new voice and presence in the department. Her press conference on
Monday.
Thank you. The days start to blur
together.
It
was just the look on your face.
Her press conference on Monday was impressive. She was commanding. She listened as well. She was open-minded, but also firm at the same time, which is a hard line to walk. And she seemed ready to dive in and tackle a huge challenge that she knows is a huge challenge.
I think the Stranger had the headline pivoting off the Onion's Obama election that said something like woman given worst job in Seattle.
Yes.
but at this point, I'm gonna take a bit of a contrarian position. I've spent a lot of time close to cops as a crime writer. I've seen really broken, dangerous police departments and sheriff's offices. Hello, Joe. Are you out there? this is not one. The problems inside SPD are much more complex, and part of it is a sense of policing within the values of Seattle, which is very tricky. So I hope that if she becomes the chief, that Chief O'Toole will talk to the rank and file and spend time on the streets and remember that downtown and Belltown are neighborhoods too, not just the area around Volunteer Park.
Can I just say from the beginning, even when there were just like 10 candidates, this person seemed to me like the obvious choice. And I've heard a lot of people say that you could almost tell going back months that she seemed like the obvious choice. And I loved one of the quotes that she had. She said, nobody dislikes a rogue cop more than a good cop because it taints them all. And I think that some of the early signs, I mean, I can't help but compare this to when John Diaz was named by Mike McGinn. The difference in sort of how the council is behaving and viewing it and how the city is responding. I mean, within minutes of this announcement, council members far and wide are tweeting out how excited they are and, you know, what a great pick and all of that. So there is excitement surrounding this as well.
Well, Milstead from Mesa would have made a very good chief, too. I mean,
you know,
he's an excellent police officer. But to me, the thing that really stood out was how beyond those two, how limited the finalists were. I mean, are you telling me that there are not command officers in the top 10 cities who would have wanted to come here? And if they didn't, that tells you something. It just hasn't been reported yet.
I agree that O'Toole seemed for a long time like the natural. And Ed Murray joked about this. She's an Irish Catholic. Yeah. He's an Irish Catholic. Another thing that we talked about, I think, on the last show, she's from Boston. Boston is often set up as a very comparable city to Seattle in terms of size, education, disposition. And just to circle back to the thing that we were talking about at the beginning of the show, Seattle's growing population. In that story in the Seattle Times, they also noted that Seattle just surpassed Boston in terms of size. And so O'Toole is moving from the city that was kind of one notch ahead of us to the city that is now one notch ahead of the city she came from.
All right. I want to pivot to the question of Macklemore and prejudice and cultural assumptions. But I want to get there by just Pennsylvania. Federal court judge in Pennsylvania strikes down a same-sex marriage ban on Tuesday. Oregon, people are looking at getting marriage licenses now. You can think about the stereotypes that gays have faced in this country and how they have been portrayed as recently as, you know, yesterday, I'm sure, in many places. But when we see how fast this tumbles, it's almost like we're not even, it's not as revolutionary in our minds anymore as to what it is. I think about what people 50 years from now are going to think as they look back on the era that preceded this one.
Well, it's moving as you say, very, very quickly. We sort of thought we were kind of daring, would you say, in 2012 when we took the vote here in the state of Washington. The referendum, the legislature had already done it. The referendum was designed to call it back. But now, wouldn't you say this debate is over? I mean, it's state by state. It's not that debate. It's a matter of when a state is going to change what it's doing, not if.
I get.
In terms of the way people will look back on this, my boyfriend and I were talking about this the other day. I hope someday we'll look back on this and say, can you believe the amount of mental and political energy we wasted for about 15 straight years in America at a time when global warming was being ignored, at a time when inequality was growing, you know, in a disastrous direction, on this question of can gay people get married? It's now settled, and the debate now seems like just a ridiculous waste of time and something we should have resolved a long time ago. In the way that they're being struck down now, you see the power of the Supreme Court's decision on DOMA, because I think that is the rationale that a lot of these federal judges are using to strike down the state bans.
It is to be hoped. Notice I don't say hopefully. It is to be hoped that the gay part of God, guns, and gays that has bolstered the reactionary Republicans through so many elections has now been removed and taken away. It remains to be seen what the backlash is from what I call the new Confederacy, which are all the red states in the old Confederacy, and then moving up into the Great Plains and you know, the other side of the Cascades.
So the new Republican mantra will be gays love God and guns too.
Well, a well-armed gay society is a polite society, as they would say.
Last Friday night, Macklemore from Seattle went on stage at the Experience Music Project, and he said this.
Welcome to our beer show with the company. By myself, a nose and a beard.
Welcome to my beard show. Bought myself a nose, bought a beard, and I'm feeling like a man for the first time in my life. Let me bring Luke in. Luke Burbank is host of Livewire. He is also does essays on CBS Sunday Morning and hosts the podcast Too Beautiful to Live, TBTL. Joining us from, where are you? You're in the land of artifice and stereotype. You're in Las Vegas.
That's right. I don't have my nose and beard on here, just because security doesn't like it. They got cameras everywhere here. But yeah, I'm down in Las Vegas, Steve. It can't all be hard podcast work. Sometimes I have to take a little time for myself.
That's very good. That's very good. All right. And Eli had this great essay, which he tweeted out. And if you get a chance to read it, from 2006, it was about being Jewish in Seattle. So we thought it was important also to bring Luke in so that it wasn't an overwhelmingly Jewish panel.
Still 3-2.
It's 3-2 now, yeah, with John and Luke. All right, so Luke, I'm starting with you. Macklemore, this issue, silly, we shouldn't have paid attention to it. That's one end of the spectrum, all the way to what the heck was he thinking? What the heck were his people thinking? Don't people recognize stereotypes still hurt in this world, even ones that are unintentional?
I didn't actually get to see Eli's piece, but I would imagine that it is very well written and that if it were to differ from my opinion, there are probably some good points I hadn't thought of. That being said, I
think that was diplomatic, but I can't tell. Maybe.
No, absolutely. I'm saying I'm not sure if I'm arguing the same argument, Eli, that you put forward or not. But
well, my piece was from 2006, so I'm not sure I'm even arguing that.
Fair enough. There are a couple of things here. I guess I'm not exactly sure what the folks who are particularly mad at Macklemore.
Seth Rogen.
Seth Rogen.
Reuven Carlyle.
I'm not exactly sure. Is the thought that Ben Haggerty, a.k.a. Macklemore, that he's actually deeply anti-Semitic and this was when he decided to show the world? Is it that they think that he is an anti-Semite? Is it that they think that more rappers will start dressing as a Jewish stereotype. I'm not. Is it that it will spread through the land and there will be anti-Semitism will grow in this country? I'm just not totally sure what the where the anger is coming from. But that's I say that as a Gentile.
I think a part of it is, and I say this as someone who spends way more time on the internet than I ever thought I would in my life, that people are constantly in search of the internet outrage du jour, and this
yes.
became that. It was tailor-made for fulminating and righteous indignation and all of that, and it had an image or many, many images attached to it that looked terrible for him. And look, it was a bad choice, and celebrities and stars and white rap stars are all kind of opinion leaders for certain people and role models for certain people. So you can legitimately say, think about the power of your visual expression. But at the same time, I agree with Luke. I'm not sure what people thought was the actual tangible, you know, real life consequence of this. At the same time, he should have apologized, and I'm glad he did.
All right, one thing before I get you guys to weigh in. We were talking about this before. You wanted one fact in the story, and so give
That's
us
right.
that.
Well, so you played this kind of hard-to-hear clip of him talking about his costume at EMP. Then later, his first kind of attempt at an apology was to tweet and say, hey, that was just me in a witch's nose, and that's not my idea of offending anyone. And we thought, okay, there's all this outrage, all this opinion. Let's see if we can find one fact in this. So we sent Anna Menard up to the costume store where Ben Haggerty, a.k.a. Macklemore, said he got this witch's nose. And we tracked down the nose. Someone called it a witch nose hunt. And we found we found the nose. And it is not a witch's nose, or it does not appear at all to be a witch's nose. It's sold, and this is maybe another problem, it's sold as a Sheikh/Fagin nose. And Fagin, as a lot of people know, is an anti-Semitic character from Dickens. Very, very old character. And so this appeared to be the nose he was wearing. And so there are problems there. But again, I think I'm with Luke. The problem is that not that he maliciously put this on, I don't get any sense of that, but that he had no idea what this might mean.
Isn't there an argument, though, and I apologize to the rest of the panel, but I haven't had any substantive conversations because I've been in Vegas for a week, so I'm really chipping at this kind of stuff.
That is true.
Could the argument be made that that's a sign of progress, that Macklemore was embodying a stereotype that I think most Americans, you guys were just talking about gay marriage and the way that it seems opinions have really changed. I mean, I think, like, I have a daughter who's 20 years old. She would not even ever know that that outfit called back to an anti-Semitic idea because she didn't grow up in a world where that's a thing people talk about very much. Isn't that kind of progress?
That is kind of progress, but there's another part of this, and that is I can't imagine somebody from the East Coast, and it's going to sound funny, but not knowing that, there may be right. a Seattle innocence, but even as, and you know, it does not seem like he intended any insult. I don't buy that he, but as I say that, I feel like, let's say it was a Supreme Court justice that wore a funny costume that was, you know, Hitler or something like that. And then, so in other words, if you like the person, you sort of spot them one. But if you don't like the person, you don't spot them.
Well, Joni's talking about an actual state Supreme Court justice in our state who did wear his Hitler costume, which got him in trouble deservedly.
Well, let me just weigh in quickly as the Gentile who says, who's Macklemore? but I think that you know, we live in an age of frightening historical ignorance, especially for Americans. There are a lot of people out there who even question that the Holocaust happened. And I think with the burden of history upon us from the consequences of anti-Semitism, even an entertainer needs to tread very carefully.
I looked at that picture when it broke on this notion of being the du jour of the day, and I thought, why is Macklemore? First, I thought, oh, he's coming from The Hobbit. He looks like one of the dwarfs in The Hobbit. And then I thought, well, he's going to get in trouble with the people who think he's racially stereotyping people who are from the Middle East. I just thought that was my initial, like, image. And so it's an odd thing to see what people see in images all the time. Outrage du jour, how much trouble Colbert got into
right.
for an incredibly deliberately racist portrayal of an Asian stereotype while trying to make a nuanced argument about why they should change the name of the Washington Redskins.
Right. But the issue with McLemore is that there wasn't any nuance or really thought to what he was doing. If he'd thought about it for a minute, he probably would have thought better of it. And to the point that Joni was making, McLemore is 30 years old. So he is right in that generation of people who could have easily grown up in Seattle, which has a very small Jewish population, and, you know, in our struggling education system, and not have any sense of the history of anti-Semitism in this country and in the world.
All right, Luke, through the magic of radio, we'll hear you on LiveWire tonight at 8 while you're in front of some craps table throwing.
Yeah, and I was actually
dice.
Thinking about bringing a menorah on stage. I don't know. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
Just have some fun with it, yeah. All right, Luke, good talking to you.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great weekend.
You too. Luke Burbank, host of LiveWire at 8 on KUOW and the TBTL podcast. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Joni Balter, news analyst for KUOW. John Talton, economics columnist for Seattle Times, roguecolumnist.com, author of a whole number of nine books, 10 books, David Mapstone Mysteries and others. Thanks for being here.